Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in downtown Washington, D.C., just a few steps from the White House, where, well, dysfunction rules. Later on the broadcast, I want to talk about that dysfunction and ask the question, really, whether or not the proper thing to do when you have an 8-year-old narcissistic king is simply to lie and flatter him, because that may be the best way to get your agenda done. I'll get to that. But first, I want to talk about a better deal. The Democrats put out a series of proposals today that are a better deal for Americans. Everything from better jobs and wages to lower costs of prescription drugs and health care, to bringing our skills into the 21st century. And for those of you who have followed the Democratic Party, any time in the last 20 years or so, really 30 years? Yeah, 30 years or so, 40 years, 50 years? Hey, go back to the New Deal, 80 years or so. Know that none of this is surprising. I can hear the pundits now. But wait, the Democrats aren't offering anything new. No, we're not. We're just offering a better life for Americans, better opportunity, equal opportunity, a chance to succeed. And that's true whether you live in the cities or the suburbs or in rural areas. These proposals are nothing new, but apparently a poll showed that only 40% of Americans even knew what the Democratic proposals were. So we can argue whether the press isn't covering them, or Democrats aren't explaining them well, or people aren't listening. But either way, it bears repeating what they are. Of course, the choice of a better deal is reminiscent of the New Deal. And I think it's important for us to remember what the New Deal was. The founder of the modern Democratic Party, of course, is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Prior to his election in 1932, from 1860 to 1932, for 72 years, the Republicans controlled everything, and they won every presidential race except for two presidents, Grover Cleveland and Woodrow Wilson. Grover Cleveland won very, very close elections, basically after corruption of the then Republican Party that had been corrupt, particularly under Grant, but also under the election of 1876, which is where we get the whole idea of a fraudulent election. It's one of those those laws trying to prevent fraud elections start. The Republican Party is pretty corrupt. Grover Cleveland got in, barely squeaked in, didn't change that much, served a couple terms. They weren't even consecutive, and there's not that much to say about Grover Cleveland. Woodrow Wilson only won because Theodore Roosevelt, who of course was a Republican, was a progressive Republican. I think many of us looking at his agenda back in the turn of the 20th century would have said, hey, that's our agenda. Things like trust busting, right? Attacking big corporations, trying to stop monopolies, the Food and Drug Administration. These are ideas that we need to care about our environment and care about the quality of our food. Yes, these are progressive ideals. Yes, that Theodore Roosevelt was a progressive. Yes, well, the Republican Party was a very different Republican Party. It was that Republican Party that freed the slaves. But increasingly, the Republicans become married to big business. Again, the only reason Woodrow Wilson wins his race is because Teddy Roosevelt runs against the Republican candidate in a three-party race. The current president of the United States at the time, President Taft, and actually beats him, but obviously the Republican Party split, and Woodrow Wilson squeaks in with 40%. The point is that for 72 years, from 1860 till 1932, there were just two Democratic presidents. 72 years, that's, of course, an entire lifetime. You couldn't vote till you were 21. Someone could vote from age 21 to 93 and only see two Democratic presidents, and Republicans controlled most of Congress at that time, too. The Democrats were a very weak party, mostly the party of, well, let's face it, the former slaveholders of the South, the party of Jim Crow, the party that was opposed to, well, Abraham Lincoln and to freeing the slaves. And but later on, the Democratic Party becomes a period, the party really of the white rural South. Kind of ironic. Back in the 1890s, a preacher by the name of William Jennings Bryan, who taught evolutionism and a lot of things we'd find very foreign to Democrats today, ran for president three times, lost three times, while big business elite New York Republicans won time after time again. That was the state of the Democratic Party, which is interesting because while the Democratic Party certainly didn't look out for black folk, it has always had a tradition of looking out for the little guy, such as the little guy is. I mean, you look at the founding of the Democratic Party, you go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. I mean, the Democratic Party is the oldest party in existence, I believe, anywhere in the world. And really, you can go back to Thomas Jefferson fighting against John Adams. Remember John Adams? He supported the Alien and Sedition Acts. I know I'm getting wonky here, but listen up. It gets good. John Adams actually put people in jail for disagreeing with his policies. He called it sedition. And if you said that you disagree with Adams' policies, he put people in jail. Wow. Donald Trump would love that, wouldn't he? There's a reason why John Adams is not my favorite founding father, and there's a reason why out of the first five presidents of the United States, he's the only one that didn't get two terms. Thomas Jefferson runs against him as more of a people's guy, right? Adams is with Hamilton. They're all with the big banks. They're, again, with Wall Street. Wall Street's been around a long time, and Jefferson's more a man of the people, a more a man of the country Virginians, at least the people as it understood at that time. Later on, the next great founder of the Democratic Party would be Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson said that white people, white men, don't have to own property to vote for president. That's a big deal at the time. Originally, you could only vote if you had property, had significant property, basically had a plantation. Most white people couldn't vote. Most white men couldn't vote. Andrew Jackson believed all white men should be able to vote. And he was so much a person of the common man that at his inauguration, he allowed the people just to come on into the White House. No barriers there. Come on in. And boy, did they have a raucous party on his inauguration. They trampled all over the furniture with their muddy footprints. The elite were aghast at the common men getting their boot prints on all the White House couches. And it got so raucous and so nasty and somewhat violent with all those rubes in the White House that some clever butler decided to put the alcohol out on the White House lawn. Luckily for Andrew Jackson, that cleared the White House and, well, saved it probably from being destroyed from the mob. Now, to be absolutely fair and truthful here, Andrew Jackson may have been for the common white man. In fact, he was. He was very much not for anyone else. Andrew Jackson, of course, did the Trail of Tears for Native Americans. He owned slaves. He very much believed in slavery. In bringing democracy to the common white man, that was a plus, but obviously it didn't include women. It didn't include blacks. But for its time, Andrew Jackson was looking out for the little guy. Things change around the 1860s. Of course, Abraham Lincoln eventually would free the slaves. And these poor white Southerners, the same ones who fought for the Confederacy, even though they didn't own slaves, would increasingly coalesce among this rump Democratic Party that at one point, from, again, 1860 to 1932, at some points only included the deep Southern states. That's how much power the Republicans had. Well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt changed all of that. All of that. When Herbert Hoover runs the economy into the ground, and again, Herbert Hoover was a well-educated, Eastern elitist guy who really didn't understand economics, but you couldn't blame him. He believed in what's called classical economics. That was what was taught him of that day. It was wrong, but I think he meant well. He did things like try to balance the budget at a time of the Great Depression, thus making the Great Depression a lot worse. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt comes along and says, I'm going to give you a new deal. Think about those words, a new deal. What is a deal? Right? First thing I think of is a deck of cards. Shuffle up and deal. You know, last time you got a two and a four. Next time you might get aces. You never know. Let's give everybody a new deal. Let's reshuffle the deck. You could imply in that some redistribution of income. But more, I think it's a chance to play again. We're losing this game. Let's throw in our cards. Let's play again. Let's have a new deal. To me, it inspires hope. It suggests equal opportunity. It suggests that everyone gets a chance to play. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt changed the course of history, changed the course of the parties. The Democrats were once again the party of the people, still not necessarily black people as of yet. We'll get to that. But the idea of economic fairness. In essence, the Democrats were still being true to their roots of looking out for the common man, understanding that the common man in Jefferson's day and in Jackson's day is not the same as the common man today. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt won in a massive landslide. Indeed, his landslide in 1936 was even bigger than his landslide in 1932, losing only two states. The New Deal. Everyone knows the New Deal. Certainly people of a certain age know the New Deal. Franklin Delano Roosevelt rescued us from the Depression. Franklin Delano Roosevelt showed that if the common man, the ordinary person, the working class American, someone joining in unions, had a chance to succeed, guess what? The whole economy prospered. If you just help the Eastern elite, as the Republicans did in the 1920s, they might have those wonderful flapper dances. Great Gatsby might have them on Long Island. But the whole thing was destined for a crash because you can't sustain a strong economy when there's no middle class, when there's no working class. The rich people can't do it alone. They just can't. That's part of what we know now from economics. That's part of what you might call John Maynard Keynesian economics, or the basic idea, that really very simple one, that a few people can't sustain an economy. It has to be broad-based. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, following up by Harry Truman, brought middle-class people a chance. People got to have their own car. People got to have their own houses. Again, mostly white people at this point. But Harry Truman talked about a fair deal, obviously harkening back to the New Deal. A fair deal. Kind of the same point. He had a little bit more trouble getting it through Congress. He didn't have that. He had a Republican Congress rather than a Democratic one. But again, using this theme of the deal. Then the 1960s come, and the Democrats reach out beyond their poor middle class, working class, white base to poor middle class, working class, really to all African Americans, to immigrants, to, you know, women had gotten the vote, actually under another Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson, and to all of America. And that worked for a while. I think Bill Clinton probably exemplified that larger mix. Remember, Bill Clinton won votes in his home state of Arkansas. Al Gore, under Bill Clinton, won his home state of Tennessee. And you had working class white people joining with black people, immigrants. We were all in it together. And really, the only people who were very angry were those people who wrote editorials for the Wall Street Journal, arguing that when Bill Clinton raised taxes on very rich people, that that would drive our economy into the dust. That's what they wrote on their editorial in 1993. The worst thing Bill Clinton could do was raise taxes on super rich people. It would destroy jobs. It would destroy the country. And, of course, the 90s gave us one of our greatest eras of prosperity since, well, oh, the 1950s, brought about by Roosevelt and Truman. So this is always been Democratic ideology. The better deal put forward by Pelosi and Schumer, which I'm going to play after the break, that's really what Democrats have always stood for. It's just that Americans maybe haven't realized it. And I want to talk about why that will be also after the break. Give a call, 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275. What is the Democratic agenda and why don't American people know it already? Right back after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal America. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Going over the history of the Democratic Party. I tried to do it all in about 15 minutes, if you're just joining in. Basically to explain why the fair deal of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi really isn't anything new. It's looking out for the little guy. That's who Democrats are. That's who they always were. Yes, I know they didn't include blacks or women or Native Americans or immigrants at the beginning. Nobody did, but it was always the Democrats pushing the ball forward. Jefferson wanted to give more rights to the common man than Adams and Hamilton. Jackson wanted more rights than, John Quincy Adams, another Adams there. Woodrow Wilson supported women voting, for example. But it was really Franklin Delano Roosevelt who took some of the progressive ideas of his Republican cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, and brought them solidly into the Democratic Party. So there's a reason why they're calling it a better deal. And, you know, it's easy to criticize nicknames. I actually think that's a good one. Whatever staffer came up with a better deal, you're a good staffer, because it harkens back to the New Deal, harkens back to a fair deal, and it says we can give you a better deal. And indeed we can. I would argue that that has always been what Democrats have offered at our best, was a better deal. And now our coalition includes everyone and not just white men. But in including everyone, we had a problem. Famously, Lyndon Johnson, when he opened up the country, the United States of America, to equality for all, Lyndon Johnson, who cared so much about rural America, rural white America, as well as black, that he was the one who did rural electrification. He's the one who strung up wires and water lines in areas that never had them before. I mean, brought electricity to rural America. These were his people, poor white people. But he knew that when he opened up the country to black people through the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, he famously said, "I've signed away the South for two generations." And we're about at the end of those two generations. Maybe, 60 years, we may have to go a little bit further. We're still living in Lyndon Johnson's signed away South. And there are still white people who resent the fact that black people are being helped too. Indeed, if you watch Fox News enough, there's this idea that black people are the only people being helped. And this idea where the upper classes divide and conquer the working classes, well, is as old as humanity. I often talk about the fact that the white Confederate soldiers, they didn't own slaves. The rich plantation owners got to stay home. The people who fought and died for the South in the Civil War were fighting for the right of other white people to further oppress black people. Well, they're being tricked again. And I think a better deal is the way out of it. We'll talk about that and give some specifics when we come back. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Democrats trotted out today a better deal, their agenda. You know, when you see a good political communication technique, use it. The Republicans tried their Contract for America back in the 1990s, and even though they haven't fulfilled much or any of it, they still used it to win votes. Famously, Republicans called for term limits, and I think one or two of them actually promised to voluntarily leave office after 6 years, and I don't know, did one do it? Maybe? They completely violated their contract with America. Some even of us called it a contract on America. but it's a good idea to run on a political platform. That should be obvious. I did it when I ran for election. Democrats should do it every election, and so I'm glad they're talking about a better deal. And they're talking about economics, and there's a reason for that. I think immigrants know where Democrats stand. I think the LGBT community knows where Democrats stand. I think African Americans, Latinos, Asians, women who care about the reproductive freedom know where the Democrats stand. I think those of us who believe that terrorists should not have easy access to guns know where the Democrats stand. Environmentalists know where the Democrats stand. But American workers, some of them have lost. Unions know, but unions are too weak, unfortunately, in America. And the ordinary American worker needs to know where Democrats stand, where we've always stood. It's really nothing new. But it's very important, nonetheless, that we let the American people know what we stand for. Here's Chuck Schumer on The Better Deal.
President Trump campaigned on a populist platform, talking to working people. That's why he won. But as soon as he got into office, he abandoned them, making alliance with the powerful, special interest, Koch brother-dominated, hard right wing of the Republican Party, which appeals to the very wealthy, not the working people, leaving a vacuum on economic issues. We Democrats are going to fill that vacuum. Democrats will show the country we are the party on the side of working people.
And we always have been.
And that we stand for three simple things. First, we're going to increase people's pay. Second, we're going to reduce their everyday expenses. And third, we're going to provide workers the tools they need for the 21st century economy. Simply put, what do Democrats stand for? A better deal for working people. Higher wages, lower costs, and the tools for a 21st century economy.
Stop right there. As a communication specialist will tell you, the easiest way to get people to remember something is to put it in threes. That's why, well, everyone except Texas Governor Rick Perry, who couldn't remember the third one. But generally, threes are a good way, and better wages, lower costs, better tools. So what are better wages? Well, Democrats have long supported a rise in the minimum wage. It's about time. It hasn't gone up in decades. It's $7.25. In fact, if you are a server in a restaurant, it can be as low as $2.13 an hour. There are places in America where your soft drink costs more than your server could earn in an hour without tips. And if you're working at 4 p.m. on a Thursday, it might be hard to get tips. Very few people eat at that time. So better wages, that includes, by the way, paid family medical leave, something that 70 or 80% support, something that, by the way, Virginia Republicans are adamantly opposed to, even though the costs are tiny, because they believe that a woman the day after birth needs to get right back to work. Doesn't matter if she's sore. Doesn't matter if the baby needs help. They don't really care about the family. They really don't really care about family values. They care about making that woman work. And now, they want to force her to have the child, to be fair. To be fair, even if she can't afford the child, they want to force her to have that child. But then they don't want to give the child health care. They don't want to let the woman bond with the child or the father, for that matter. No bonding allowed. Get back to work. They hate paid family medical leave, even though every other industrialized nation, in fact, every country on the planet, except two, I've heard it's the United States and Papua New Guinea. What's wrong with you, Papua New Guinea? You can't be as heartless as the United States. Allows at least maternal leave, paid maternal leave. Most allow paternal leave. Because God knows when your baby's being born, the first thing you think about is how well you can do your job. Well, of course not. And that's why people quit. And that's why women's wages are often lower. And that's why companies have to spend a lot of money on retraining. Doesn't make sense economically. And also, when your parents are dying, mom or dad, who've loved you and taken care of you your entire life, are taking their last breath. Republicans believe the most important thing at that point should be doing your job. Mom, dad, goodbye, whatever. No time for funerals. Get back to work. That's the Republican agenda. Democrats offer a better deal. We think that at the time your baby is born or the time your parents are dying, you may not be thinking about work. You might actually be thinking about the most important moments in your life. And if your employer allows you to take a little bit of time off with pay, that you'll actually come back to your job refreshed and ready to go without your mind concentrating on something else. So it's good for employers too. Poor massive corporations. I know it's so hard for them. They've only made massive profits and they might have to only increase their wages by increase their earnings by $112 million instead of $111 million this year. Poor CEOs. They have to take, you know, a little bit of ding out of their bank book. It's actually very little cost. So yes, better wages, but also lower costs. Lower costs matter, particularly when it comes to prescription drugs. One of the first battles I remember fighting when I was legislative counsel to Congressman Barney Frank in the early Bush years was whether the government, whether Medicare, could negotiate better prices for their drugs, for our drugs, for American people's drugs. And given that Canada does it, and the UK does it, and France does it, and Japan does it, and Australia does it, and Germany does it, and every rational industrialized country in the world does it, you'd think that the government, elected by the people, would stand up for the people and get a good deal. Get a fair deal. Get a new deal. Get a better deal. Hey, negotiator. Hey, supposed great negotiator. Donald Trump never negotiated a thing for the American people. He's all about putting money in his own pockets. But if you were going to negotiate a deal, use the power of the federal government to get down those prices, right? No. Not even free market, not even the power of the government. The Republicans, when they controlled the House and the presidency in the early Bush years, even though Al Gore won the election, you know, just like Hillary Clinton got the popular vote, they used their minority power to ban the government from negotiating the best deal for the American people. Because their view was, the American people, screw you. We don't give a damn about you. What are you, voters? We don't care about you. We care about the companies that are giving us a lot of money in our campaign checks. Which is why fighting special interests is also part of the better deal, a crucial part of the better deal. Frankly, we need public financing of campaigns. We shouldn't have politicians bought off by special interests. The best way to do that, I've often argued, is my own plan that I like to call Politibucks. Some of you have heard of it. If the Democrats ever take power in Virginia, I'm going to introduce it. Basically, it gives a certain amount of money to every Virginian, and I think it should be an American program. I think every American should get $100 that you can't spend. Sorry, you can't eat it, can't drink it. All you can do is spend $100 on politicians, whatever ones you like, local, state, federal, whatever party you like, Republican, Democrat, Green, Libertarian, anybody. And $100 in Politibucks for 300 million Americans or 250 million voters, do the math, it's about $25 billion. And guess what? Suddenly we can compete with the Koch brothers. We, the American people, have a bigger voice than two very, very rich billionaires. Wow! And it would start to cut the connection between legalized bribery that often exists in politics and the politicians. So yes, better jobs, better wages, lower costs, cut out the special interests, and yes, better tools. Tools like retraining. Tools like saying, you know, coal jobs have gone way down to the dirt, and it isn't because of the environmentalists, it's because of the economy. You know what? Environmentalists didn't cause the horses to no longer be our primary mode of transportation, even though I'm sure they didn't like all that manure in the streets. No, the reason why the poor horseshoe maker doesn't have a job anymore was not a massive conspiracy to get out those free-riding horsemen of the plains. It's not because we hate horses. It's because, well, the car did a better job. Sorry, I like to ride horses too. Nothing against horses. The reason why coal is failing is because coal is dirty, and coal is expensive. And coal, when you take account of pollution costs, is inordinately expensive. So let's spread something else in rural areas. Lyndon Johnson brought us rural electrification. Mark Levine supports rural internetification. Okay, maybe I need a better phrase for it. We need to string broadband up, internet up in rural areas. We need to do to rural areas in 2017 what Lyndon Johnson did for rural areas in the 1960s, 50 years ago. Then he brought them electricity and water. We now need to bring them internet. Internet is the job of the future. Now you can telecommute. And this better deal, you know, it's not exciting. It just works. When people need a job, it just works better. And sometimes, well, I won't say sometimes. I would say all the time that a lot of the right-wing communication people will tell you, no, you have to divide and conquer. You got to make white people hate black people. You need to make citizens hate immigrants. You need to make straight people hate gay people. You need to make English-speaking people hate non-English-speaking people. And by dividing us up and all that, the elite can just come on in and do something like cut everybody's health care to give them a massive tax cut. And if you don't doubt that this is something planned, this isn't an accident, look at the way America has dealt with two drug crises. Compare the crack epidemic with the opioid epidemic. The crack epidemic in the 80s and the 90s largely affected America's inner cities, largely affected urban youth, largely affected African Americans and Latino Americans. Now, a lot of white people were doing cocaine. At the time, a lot of black people were doing crack. Crack is cheaper than cocaine. But that's when we began the war on drugs. That's when we started mass incarceration. That's when the number of Americans in the jail, which had been moving steadily along, maybe close to 200,000, one in 1,000 people in a country of 200 million, and leaped up in the 80s, leaped up under Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. to about 1.2 million Americans behind bars. It went up six times. We went to one in 1,000 Americans behind bars to, one in 200, less, actually. And then, by giving all these poor people criminal records, largely black people, then they couldn't get a job. In Virginia, they were denied the right to vote, and it left a permanent underclass, mostly for nonviolent drug possession. Fast forward, 2017, there's a massive opioid epidemic. Only most of the users are white. And they don't live in the cities. Most of them live in rural communities. We don't have a massive opioid problem in Alexandria, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. They've got it in the rural South. And now the Republicans actually seem to care about their voters, these poor drug-addicted people who I feel sorry for as well. But we Democrats have said in the 80s and the 90s and today, any drug user is not a criminal. There's someone who needs our help. We need money for rehab centers, which are cheaper than prisons. And I don't care whether it's cocaine or crack or opioids. Jailing them doesn't solve the problem. It makes it worse. It leads to a black market. It leads to gangs. It leads to gang warfare in our streets. Prohibition didn't work either. But note that when it's black people's drug, jail them is the cry of the Republican Party. And when it's poor white people's drug, help them. Well, I'm glad they're helping. It's the right thing to do. But it's the right thing to do for anyone addicted to drugs. It's cheaper than prison, and it's a lot more compassionate. But it's all about dividing us up. It's all about saying, oh, watch out for that dangerous crack-addled black person. But we need to help that opioid-addled white person. Come on. Come on. Compassion should never have a color. And if you have any doubt that the Republicans' agenda is basic racism and xenophobia, you haven't been listening to them very much. Xenophobia, of course, is hatred of foreigners, hatred of immigrants. The better deal of the Democratic Party is not divided by race or color or citizenship. It just says we all need a better deal, and particularly those that are struggling economically, they need a better deal. And nowhere is that difference more clear than in healthcare. And I'll get to that after the break. If you want to give us a call, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Join the discussion if you like. We'll be right back right after this.
Schooling the GOP, one hand tied behind his back, the Constitution in the other. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Just got about 4 minutes left. I do want to go to the phones at 888-488-MARK. Go to Tom on line one in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for calling in.
I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I actually met you in person several years ago at a Straight Survivor reunion.
Yeah, I've always made a strong practice at trying to fight child abuse wherever it occurs, and you're one of my causes, Tom. One of my many,
right,
but that's something that I
actually,
certainly firmly believe
what made
in.
What made me call in, I was listening to you going over the history.
Yeah.
And going over everything with the, you know, the history of the Republicans and their agenda. And last year's election, when Bernie lost the nomination, caused me to just do a lot of research. And it's like, okay, when did the Republicans and the Democrats completely flip-flop with being conservative, you know, and liberal and what have you, what their agenda was? As I recall, in 1854, when the Whigs and the Free Soil Democrats created the Republican Party, one of Lincoln's quotes was that they wanted to lift the artificial burdens on the common man and make it easier for immigrants to get started here.
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't sound like today's
Republican. No, no, and Teddy Roosevelt talked about busting the big corporations. He'd want to tear apart Standard Oil and the Carnegies and the steel, and he really tore apart big monopolistic industry. I would say that the Republican Party started to marry big business soon after Teddy Roosevelt, soon after he lost,
right,
frankly, running against Taft as a progressive, as a third-party progressive. And I would say the Democrats have always had this common man idea, although, as I pointed out, who the common man was, that understanding grew over time, right? Jefferson believed that it should be most anyone that owned property. And then Jackson said, well, any white man, whether or not they own property. And then Wilson brought in women, but it wasn't until the civil rights era of the 1960s where we brought in African Americans as well. But really,
when there is a huge push. During civil rights. 60,
that's right. That's when Republicans
that's
switched.
When the Republicans,
that's right.
They went really hard right. Somewhere,
well,
and that's where I'm a little fuzzy. But
well, I suggest do some research on Nixon's Southern strategy. So
right.
What happened is, so Franklin Delano Roosevelt was obviously helping all people, all working class people. That's why the industrialists hated him. The corporations hated him, and that's where the New Deal comes from. But after the 1960s, after the Democrats started supporting civil rights, there are a lot of Southern whites who supported the racism and segregation. They didn't feel like the Republican Party was a place they could go. Lincoln freed the slaves. They didn't feel like the Democratic Party was a place they could go, you know, not with Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy. So they supported,
right,
George Wallace, who did very well in the election of 1968 and actually won a few states. Richard Nixon made a conscious decision between 68 and 72 to pick up the Wallace vote, to move that white racist Southern vote from the Democratic Party to the Republican,
right,
Party, and he succeeded, and that's one of the reasons why in 1972 he won
Southern
in a landslide.
Democrats.
So I think you'll find that the heart of the change was between 1968 and 1972. It was reaction against the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and a very conscious strategy by Richard Nixon to bring in that racist vote. And then Ronald Reagan did racism with a smile. Right, he was a very genial guy, a very nice guy, but he would make up lies about, you know, the welfare queens, the welfare limousine, right? He talked about someone collecting the welfare checks and driving a limousine. It was a completely made-up story, but Ronald Reagan taught a lot of white people to hate black people, to fear poor black people, and I would argue we're still living with his legacy today. Thanks for calling in, Tom. I'm afraid my time is up. I'll be back on Wednesday. Tune in then for more of the Inside Scoop.